Accession number 27460, reel 22.
Mr. Wilkes, reel 22. Were the natives employed in the leave camp?
Yes. Oh, yes.
What tasks were they doing for you?
Well, where I was, each morning I was brought a mug of hot tea and two slices of toast, and that was to help to wake me up, which it did. I got spoiled with all that. And then they would make the beds and sweep the room out. I had nothing to do for myself. Everything was done for me. So our usual routine was to hire the ponies, go for a ride in the morning, come back in the afternoon, write letters and read and sleep, and then get up for our evening meal and then walk around the bazaars. And that was it. It was a complete relaxation. I think riding the ponies possibly did me a bit of harm, because my back seemed to suffer with their little jogging trots. But, you know, we used to feel sorry for these ponies. We used to take them out to where there was plenty of grass and then get off them and let them graze. I suppose we're doing wrong, but bless them. The very first horse I hired there, it was called Simple Simon. And he had a way of his own, and by I got used to him, it was time to hand him back in. The following morning, when I went to see if I could get him, he'd been involved in an accident. A lady had hired him and tried to ride him down lots of steps, with being so hilly that when she tried to ride him down the steps, he'd fallen and broken his knees and had to be destroyed. So I was quite upset about this.
Were there many civilians in Darjeeling?
Oh, yes.
Now, how did you get on with those?
Well, they didn't get involved with us. No one invited us anywhere. They just talked to us if they met us, and just slight talk. And they didn't sort of say, well, you're soldiers, how are you finding things? Of course, there were so many soldiers that had just come from India that hadn't seen action.
Were they what you might call the traditional colonial?
Yes.
Colonialist in...
That's right.
In their actions and responses.
That's right.
And you were there 14 days, you said?
Yes.
What happened to you then?
Well, the day arrived when we had to go home. So, in the morning, the first thing, we had to put on our uniforms for down on the plains. And... which was our jungle green battle dress, really, because we didn't have any other dress with us at the front. And so we had to put that on, which was light, and we felt quite cold during the morning. But we had our... After lunch, we had to go and we would get the train somewhere in the late afternoon that would take us down. And this was the first experience I had of being in a carriage that came off the rails as we're rattling down the tracks. Now, each of these carriages was independently braked. The braking system was very primitive, because on the front of each carriage was a long lever mounted crossways over, and it was pivoted near to one end, and there was a man riding on the top of the carriage, and he would stand on this lever and walk to make use of the leverage for it to pull the brakes on. It was linked to the brakeage, to the braking system, and he would bring the thing to a halt. And of course, we were going down the hill, and suddenly, bump, 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 we were running over the sleepers, and we came to a halt. We put the carriage back on the lines and went down. As we travelled down, just before it was dark, and we could see across the plains, they looked scorched with the heat, and we'd come from where everything was so green. And
is it a beautiful country, India?
It is, if you know what to look for. There's something about India that I love, And when I went back last year, I don't know, there was something as if it was calling me.
Did you see the poverty of the
place? Oh, that is the thing that distressed me a lot. You had to turn a blind eye to it. They appeared to live with it and could cope with it. But it was something that it's always remained with me.
Did you experience any of the anti-British feelings at that time when you were there?
Yes. When we first arrived in India, there was a lot of what we referred to as Gandhiwalas. And there were big notices, go home, you dirty British, and get out of our country, and things like that. We were only allowed out in parties of seven when we went out of our camp anywhere. But that was in Bangalore. After we left Bangalore, there was none of it. We did see signs, but we could go out singly down on the Kola goldfields. And now, well, there was no problem.
Well, you're now heading back. But no,
yes,
presumably you had the problem, if that's right, of finding your unit.
Yes, well, at the moment, what we had to do was get a train from the foothills down to Calcutta. And that was no problem. And I remember saying to the other two, I bet we don't have to bribe anyone to get back on the train back up to the front. And I was right. We were on a train that night heading back up to the front. But I took ill. I practically lost consciousness. I'd gone down with dengue fever and I was really ill, and I was taken off the train at a place called Santahar. Now, I remember my two friends had got very concerned for me, and there were two newspaper reporters on the train, and I know one of them, he'd managed to get some ice from somewhere, and he had some ice wrapped in a little towel which he was applying to my head. Funny enough, I came across the towel a year or so ago amongst my belongings. Still have it. Anyway, I was taken off the train. My two friends went on. And I had to spend the night in an Indian hospital. And the following morning, an Indian doctor came in and apologised that they hadn't any English food for me. But he did manage to get some of these rich tea biscuits from somewhere, and so I had a biscuit and a cup of tea. Not that I could eat, and I couldn't keep anything down.
How had you caught it? Is there a...
I'm not sure how dengue is contracted. It's a similar fever to malaria, and it can be fatal. So anyway, I had an awful day. I was just coming in and out of consciousness all day. So when it got to evening, I was going to be put back on a train to Calcutta. And I was carried out on a stretcher and laid between the tracks beside the railway. And one of the native orderlies, he said to me to keep an eye on one of these other men that was carried out. He was very dangerous. Don't let him get hold of a knife. He was battle happy. These men had come back, and they were bomb happy. You know, they were in a bad state. And this was the distressing part, to see such wonderful soldiers reduced to nervous wrecks. And eventually, I was put in a compartment. I'm not certain there were 8 or 10 of us, all madmen. I was put up on a top bunk, and I don't think I could have cared very much whether they went for me or not, but I just sort of slept in and out of consciousness. But when we got to a station, I was taken off and taken into an Indian hospital once again, and there was...
Do you recall where this station was?
I can't, but it wasn't far from Calcutta. And it was one of these places built of bamboo and reeds and things. It was a big basher, a very big ward. and fastened to one of the bamboo poles was a bed, a charpoy, and on it was an Indian sergeant, Havildar, as his rank was, and all he did was shout and scream all day and all night. His feet were tied to the bed, his hands were tied to the bed. And, I think of it many and many and many a time. Whatever happened to him, I just don't know. But I think I was in there for about 24 hours, and then I was moved into the hospital in Barrackpore. There I was being treated.
What treatment do they give you for dengue fever?
I'm not sure, but it could have been quinine. I can't quite... I've had dengue fever twice, and I've had malaria twice. But I can remember the cure for the malaria, but I can't remember the cure for dengue. And I rather think it was the same. But anyway, I was put into this hospital in Barrackpore. And, of course, whilst in there, it was noticed that my back was causing me some problems. And the doctor, when he was on his rounds, he would test it. And he was a bit brutal in what he did and left me out of breath and struggling. And he said I was to be confined to bed for 10 days. And I had to attend the masseur every day. And so that was that.
Was this a military hospital again?
Oh, it was a full military hospital.
And British Indian staffed?
Yes. Yes, mainly British. And funny enough, I knew that my brother-in-law's fiancée was a nurse there. And I had hoped to see her whilst there, but I was ejected.
So there were female members of the nursing staff?
Oh, yes. Anyway...
How did they treat you overall? Was it a strictly disciplined hospital?
Oh, very disciplined, yes.
You didn't have to lie to attention in your beds when you were inspected, this kind of thing, had you?
Well, you were expected to be to attention. You didn't just lie haphazard. I mean, you have to give respect to the doctors. Yes, sir, no, sir, etc. Anyway, I had one dose of massage and I was put back into my bed. And then the following morning, when the doctor was on his rounds, he said I could be discharged. One of the nurses said the reason was there was a Lord Munster coming round to visit the hospital, and all the beds, when they were made up with someone in, had to have a red blanket folded in a certain way across the foot of the bed, and they didn't have enough red blankets, so I could be discharged. So I was in so much pain I couldn't carry my kit. I had to hire a coolie to carry my kit, and I was just discharged like that, make your way to the transit camp. So I got a rickshaw and went to the camp because I was running very low for money. I hadn't bothered to get any more. I was going back to my regiment. I'd be all right. So this set me back a little bit. So I went to the transit camp and I was bedded down for the night, and the following morning I was making inquiries about getting back to my regiment, and they said, oh yes, we'll send you back. And I said, now what's the chance of drawing any pay? If you've got your pay book, no problem. Thank you. There'll be a pay parade at whatever time, 10 or 11 o'clock. So I went along and I saw this parade of men. Now they're talking a peculiar language. And their dress was rather different to ours. And it turned out they were all Italian prisoners of war. And so I said to the British orderly, I said, "Do you expect me to stand behind these in a queue to draw some money?" He said, "Yeah, if you want some money, that's what you've got to do." I said, "Well, I'll go without," which I did.
These presumably came from the desert.
Yes, that's right.
Did they look well cared for?
They did. Better than we were. Their uniforms were tidy and everything. Of course, I suppose, being Italians, they were better cared for now than they'd ever been at home.
Now, of course, Italy was ostensibly on our side at that time. They'd come out of the war in 43.
That's right, yes. And that's why I suppose they were being treated the way I... Well, I was being treated the way that... So anyway, I think I had another night in this transit camp. And then it was another night move the following day. And I was improving. I was able to carry my kit. And I remember I'd gone out into the town and I'd bought myself a meal. I'd had some fried eggs at this cafe somewhere. And I can remember this American who was in front of me, and he wanted two eggs fried sunny side up. So anyway, night time came and boarded the train. No lights. No lights on it whatsoever. But one or two chaps had got candles, and they lit these candles, and we travelled away, and we got to the ferry, and then across the ferry, and eventually, after a long, long journey, we arrived at Dimapur. Well, Dimapur, up to Imphal, no trouble. I quickly got transport up to Imphal.
Do you, when you say you get transport, do you report on arrival to a transport officer at every station?
Yes.
Or whatever?
Oh, yes. Reporting.
And they put you on the, or indicate where you should go. And
yes. Oh, well, as soon as I said I was making for Imphal, my regiment was... So anyway, yes, I was put on a lorry and up to Imphal. And then it was full stop. And... it was whilst I was there, I had to spend a few days there. I kept going to the office each morning to see if there was any chance of getting back, and pushing the fact that I was needed. I didn't know that I was, but I thought I would be. If the regiment has moved, I thought they're bound to want me. So anyway, I remember this particular day, I was put in charge of a burial party. There was a young man had died, and... when it came to lifting the coffin, this young fellow, this young soldier, he couldn't take his corner. And I just took it for him, rather than push my rank and make him. I did it. And then, worst of all, was when we got the coffin put into the ground. The coffin wasn't lying straight. And that wouldn't do for me. I was a bit of a precisionist. And I asked the minister to hold on. And I went down, wedging my feet as I went. And I managed to pull earth out with my bare hands till I got that coffin as I wanted it. And the service was continued. And that young man, whoever he was laid to rest.
And that would... Was it a typical military funeral? Or just a question of taking him along and put him in a hole?
Well, I'd never been to a military funeral as such before. See, so this, I thought, must be something that was done behind the lines. Whilst at Imphal there, I was making inquiries about the hospital for mules, and I found it was a very big hospital, and that at the current time there were 350 sick and wounded mules in there. So that was a matter of interest for me.
Transit camps have a reputation of not being a particularly pleasant places to be in.
They weren't. We were... Our beds, as such, it was like a shelf about 3 feet off the ground. It was made of split bamboo lying crossover. Consequently, your back was like a corrugated sheet when you woke up. And you lay just on a blanket on that. There were no palliasses or anything.
And were you just pushed from pillar to post just to fill time in?
Well, I I don't think we did very much. There was a parade each morning, and then you just went back to rest. I know whilst I was there, they were wanting volunteers to go on the Dakotas to push supplies out when they were doing airdrops. And I volunteered. And the sergeant said, "You're a married man." He said, "If anything happens, your wife will not get any compensation." So I...
That's because she'd volunteered for something which you weren't
that's
intended
right, yes.
to do.
That's right. So I didn't do it.
Did you find a difference between the frontline active soldier and the back area people when you met them?
I don't think those behind the line were envious at all of what we were doing, but I think they were rather rigid and I'm in charge here.
More regimental in a way.
Yes. Yeah.
And did that irk when you were coming out of the line expecting to totally relax without being pushed around?
It was just like water off a duck's back. We took everything as it came. So I was there quite a few days, and I'd been to the office this particular morning, and I knew that I wasn't going to be called, you know, I wasn't going to be called to go on to rejoin my regiment. And I went on the morning parade as per usual, and then I was back where I was, where my sleeping quarters were, and a sergeant came down. He said, "You're going back to your regiment tomorrow." He said, "Report at 8 o'clock or 8:30, whatever time it was." So I said, "Right, whereabouts are they?" And he said, "Oh, I don't know, you'll have to find that out tomorrow." So the next morning, of course, I reported, and there were two lorries to take a load of troops back up to the front. And the front lorry had two drivers, and the other lorry had one driver. And so I would ride in the second lorry because that was I would have a front seat. And so we had to go to Tamu, and that was as far as the lorries would take us. So we set off.
Were you concerned at any time that you may not get back to your regiment? You'd been away for quite a while, hadn't you?
By now I'd been away about a month or 5 weeks.
They must have been... Were you wondering what they thought had happened to you, you know?
Yes.
Deserted or something of that nature?
Well, I didn't think they would think I was deserted, because if they'd made inquiries, they'd have known jolly well where I was. Because I left a trail wherever I went. But anyway, we set off. Well, the driving of the vehicle in front was horrific. And for all I was sitting beside an Indian driver, I could hear him making gasps of amazement. Sometimes we'd see one of the twin wheels of the vehicle in front go over the precipice edge. It was swerving about from side to side. And I thought, we've got to get him stopped somehow, but how? And we were trying to keep up with him. And eventually, there was a mishap. We'd seen some of the men in the back getting ready to jump out, but then three of them did jump out. And one broke his back. And the truck pulled into the side, and I don't know what he ran his vehicle against, but he managed to stop. And, of course, he immediately was saying his brakes had failed. And the first thing I did, I checked the hydraulics and found no fluid in. So I knew that someone hadn't been servicing, and these vehicles were serviced. There was no reason for anyone to have had a situation like that, because the brakes were checked on these service points every so many miles. So it wasn't long before the military police were on the scene, and of course plenty of troops were trying to look after those that had jumped. Two had hurt themselves, but not seriously, but the lad that had broken his back, they got him onto the tailboard of one of the lorries and moved him to the side of the road until an ambulance arrived. I wanted the military police to put this driver under arrest, and they wouldn't. but I don't know why. I mean, there were British police, Indian drivers, but whether they didn't want to cause any trouble, I don't know. But anyway, eventually the ambulance arrived, and another lorry would take these troops on. I said I would go to the hospital to see what the damage was to this man before, as I knew I would have to make a report. So anyway, when the ambulance did come and was going to take him away, I was told I couldn't ride on it, and I had to foot slog it up to the hospital. And that was when I was told he had broken his back. That was confirmed. So anyway, then I managed to hitchhike with the vehicles till I got to Tamu. On arrival at Tamu, I was very late for reporting in, and the sentry at this transit camp, he immediately said I had to report to the commanding officer on my arrival. So I thought, well, I'll be in deep hot water to start with, but if I give a proper report, it should be okay. So he was a very understanding gentleman, and listened to what I had to say. And then he just told me, before he would listen to my story, he said, have you had anything to eat today? I said, no. And so he said, well, go and get something to eat and then come back and tell me all about it. Which I did. And then he said, we're flying you in tomorrow. So that was a help. The regiment had moved and they were wanting me. So I knew I was in demand.
So they must have moved quite a distance in all the time, you know, that you were away.
Yes, calculating, I don't know just how far, but you see, as I say, we'd pulled back down the Tidham Road, so they had to come back up all that road, maybe 40 miles, 50 miles, to Tamu, and then they'd moved on from Tamu. Now, I later learnt that one battery had still continued down the Tidham Road, and the other battery that had been with us all along, they had been pushing off down the Cabourg Valley.
Was that the 522?
Yes.
For that one.
So
the batteries could be quite a distance away from each other in this situation.
In an account that was given to me by one of our troops who's read the account of the regiment, he said, for all, at one time, the batteries were 69 miles apart. We kept in contact and kept the precision. How are you doing?